Thank you, Rabbi Summers. And I don't have to tell you that the Rosh Yeshiva felt very close to Rabbi Summers, and it's beautiful to see carrying on the Masorah. The Gemara tells us an interesting event that occurred to Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas. Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas was known as Marad Eretz Yisrael. He was the master in Halacha. He was one of the greatest leading sages in the time of the Amoraim, and to his address came all questions. Interestingly enough, whilst he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a very righteous person, he lived a very austere, difficult life. He suffered poverty, he suffered illness, and if you had to assess his life in general, it was pretty rough. The Gemara gives us an example of what his life was like. One day the Gemara tells us he was Ovid Milsa, he went for medical procedure, and when he came back to his home, he had nothing to eat. And nothing to eat doesn't mean there was meager provisions. It was literally a bare cupboard. He was so hungry that he found a clove of garlic, he bit into it, and he passed out, literally unconscious. The word quickly spread amongst the Rabbanan that the great Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas is unconscious, and they came to visit. And the Gemara explains to us, the Gemara tells us what they saw while he was unconscious. While he's lying there on the floor, first he begins crying, then he begins laughing, then a beam of light emanates from his forehead. When he awoke, the Rabbanan asked him, "My high, what was the meaning of this, the crying, the laughing, the beam of light?" He said as follows, "While I was unconscious, Yosef Imi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem himself came to visit, and I said to Hashem, Ad Mosai et Sta'er by Alma, Hashem, until when will I suffer in this world? At which point Hashem said to me, Elazar b'ni, Elazar my son, Nichlach da Abcha la Alma Meresha, is it good for you? Would you like me to turn back the world to its moment of creation? Efsha de Mishas b'shas de Mazoni, maybe you'll be born into a time of sustenance." I said to Hashem, Kuli hai de Efsha, you'll turn back the world to its moment of creation, thank you, and maybe I'll be born into a time of sustenance, maybe. I said to Hashem, tell me this, did I already live past the halfway mark? Did I already live out half of my years? Apparently he wasn't sure that he had the moral fortitude, that he had the strength to go back. Hashem said, you already passed the halfway mark. In that case, he said to Hashem, no, put me back into the life that I had been living, put me back into that existence. Hashem said, the reward that you're going to receive for saying that you want to go back is an estate that's so wide and so vast that there are 13 rivers running through it. The Marshal explains to us that his reward is in the world to come. There are no estates, there are no rivers. It's a mushal, if you want a parable, in a world without physicality, if you want to try to perceive it, imagine a man who's so wealthy, has an entire estate, so wide and so vast, that there are literally 13 rivers running through it. That's his world to come, and that's what Hashem says is coming to him. At which point, Rabbi Elazar goes on to say that he said to Hashem as follows, Kule hai, that's all, and no more? Just 13 rivers? At which point Hashem said to him, if I'm going to give you more, what am I going to have left for your friends? At which point he said, give me those portions of those who didn't earn it. The Marshal explains to us that when Hashem creates each Jew, Hashem creates for that person a portion in the world to come. If they earn it, it's theirs. If not, it's left over. Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas was saying, give me those portions from those who didn't earn it. At which point Hashem Kaviyocha was entertained, touched Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas on the forehead and said, giri bach, as if to say, touche. And after that point, he awoke. And this is the outline of the Gemara. What I'd like to do is study this Gemara together because it is rather perplexing and rather difficult to understand until we delve into it. So let me begin with two questions. The first question is that we're dealing with a profound Talmud Chacham, a great individual, and Hashem tells him that the reward that's coming to him for his effort is an estate so wide and so vast. Imagine 13 rivers running through this huge swath of land. What is his response? Kuli hai v'sulo, that's all? Just 13 rivers? That does not sound like an appropriate comment for a great man to say to Hashem. When Hashem just told him, your work will be well rewarded, you're going to be a tremendously rewarded individual, I would assume the appropriate response would be, thank you very much, I greatly appreciate it. But that's not what he said. Kulei havsulo, no more than that. Number one, it doesn't sound appropriate. But the second question is far more profound. And that is, if we're dealing with a great man, if we're dealing with a human being who actually uses his life appropriately, a man who's dedicated to his people, a man who puts his own self-interest aside and truly devotes himself to the Klal Yisrael, wouldn't you imagine that Hashem would respond to this person differently? Rabbi Elazar ben Midas is suffering. He's suffering a very difficult life. He's suffering such a difficult life that when Hashem visits him, the very first words out of his mouth is, Ad Mosai et Star by Alma, Hashem, until when will I suffer in this world? Wouldn't you imagine that Hashem would say to him, okay, Elazar, you're a good fellow. You've done well. I'll take care of you. Not only doesn't Hashem say that, Hashem says, Elazar, do you want me to turn back the world to its moment of creation? Maybe you'll be born into a time of mazonos, of sustenance. If I were a Elazar ben Midas, I would say, don't turn back the world to its moment of creation. How about a cup of coffee and a tuna fish sandwich? He wasn't asking for wealth. He wasn't asking for riches. He was asking for basic sustenance. Yet not only didn't Hashem say, okay, I'll take care of you, Hashem says this perplexing expression, do you want me to turn back the world to its moment of creation? Maybe you'll be born into a time of sustenance. The question is, what's pshat? What does this mean? Why didn't Hashem just say, okay, I'll take care of you? And let's start with the second question first. Let's see if we can answer that and get a better understanding as to what this Gemara is telling us. And to do that, I'd like to share with you a mashal, a parable. Imagine that an actor gets a call from his agent. We'll give this actor a name. I don't know who's, I'm a little out of touch with the today's movies, folks. Give me a male actor. Male actor, famous male actor. Cary
Grant.
Sorry? That's worse than I thought. I got to teach, I got to go to high school tomorrow. Give me somebody young, handsome, and...
Okay, that is DiCaprio.
Russell
Crowe. Alright, I'm going to stick with Robert Redford. That's how old I am. I was going to say, you should know for the record, I'm embarrassed to say how old I was going to. Alright, let me stick. This is bad news, folks. Alright, let me stick with Robert Redford. Anyway, Robert Redford gets a call from his agent. Robert, listen, I got a great script. I'm sending it by tomorrow. It's a guaranteed Oscar. I'm sending it by. I want you to sign on it. Robert gets the script, reads it through. His agent calls the next day. Rob, we're going to do it, right? Nope. Is it the other actors? Not the other actors. Is it the cash? We'll get more cash. I'm not doing it. Rob, what's the problem? Don't you understand? Playing this part has me playing the part of a luckless down and out. Yeah, but that's just the part you're playing. We're going to do it, right? I can't stand the embarrassment. The whole world is going to see me a loser as a down and out. I'm not playing the part. I'm not doing it. Click, hands up the phone. That conversation never happened. Why? Because every actor, as well as everyone going to the theater, understands that the actor is judged on one criteria. The criteria that the actor is judged by is how well did he play his part. If his part is to be an idiot savant, and he plays it convincingly, he'll win an Oscar, he'll win awards. If his part to play is to be a glib, sophisticated, very successful individual, and he plays that part poorly, the critics will rip him to shreds. He's judged on one single criteria. He's given a script and put into a particular role, and then he's judged by how well he played that part. I believe that that is an apt parable for our lives. Before we were created, Hashem gave each individual a very particular stage setting, a particular script, and Hashem said, go out and live your life. Go out there, ford those streams, climb those mountains. At the end of your days, you will be judged. But at the end of our days, I will not be judged as compared to you. You will not be compared to someone else. I will be judged by the most exacting, demanding standard imaginable. They'll hold up a picture of me and they'll say, that is you. Based on your talents, based on your abilities, based on what you could have been had you used your time appropriately, that is what you should have been. And that is the most demanding standard imaginable. However, it takes an awful lot of understanding to recognize that all of the trappings of life, all of the stage settings are merely that. Just stage settings put out there, they're not relevant, they're not really significant. The only thing that really matters is one thing, based on your God-given talent and ability, how far did you go? My son was bar mitzvahed a number of years back, and we decided to have a small Shabbos event. We borrowed a shul in Muncie that was a private shtiebel, and it happened to be that that shtiebel only had a small Sefer Torah. And at my son's bar mitzvah, I told the following story of another small Sefer Torah that had recently been in the news. You know, if you want, I'll do this after. I'll post the after. But yeah, it really is. I want you to, it's much more fun. This is the shul. We'll do it after. I'll stand up and, okay. Thank you. I got up to my son's bar mitzvah and I told the following story. There had been another boy who had lain from a very small Sefer Torah. A Rabbi Dasberg had met this young fellow, Joachim Yosef, and this Rabbi Dasberg approached him and said to him as follows, I want you to lane. Joachim Yosef refused. Rabbi Dasberg persevered. Joachim Yosef still refused. Rabbi Dasberg said to him, I want to teach you how to lane, and I want you to lane from the Sefer Torah. In the end, Rabbi Dasberg convinces Joachim Yosef, and in Auschwitz, Joachim Yosef leaned from a very small Sefer Torah, because Rabbi Dasberg had smuggled it in when he was brought into Auschwitz, and under the watchful eyes of the Nazis, this boy was bar mitzvah. After he leaned from this very small Sefer Torah, Rabbi Dasberg turned to him and said as follows, now I want you to take this Sefer Torah. And Joachim Yosef said, I'm a little boy, I can't take the responsibility. Rabbi Dasberg said, you don't understand. I'm an old man, I don't think I'm going to make it out of here. I want you to take the Sefer Torah, and I want you to promise me that the whole world hears about it. Rabbi Dasberg was very persevering. In the end, Joachim Yosef agreed. He took the Sefer Torah. Interestingly enough, he survived. He made it to the displaced persons camps. He made it to Eretz Yisrael. He took that small Sefer Torah, put it in a closet in his apartment, and it remained there for 57 years. Ilan Ramon, the Israeli astronaut, was preparing for his space mission on the Columbia. He had a certain question in science, so he met with Dr. Joachim Yosef in Dr. Yosef's apartment. And somehow during the meeting, this small Sefer Torah came up under discussion, and Ilan Ramon asked Dr. Yosef if he could take this up with him on the Columbia. As a matter of fact, that's what he did. As you probably remember the story, the entire world read about the Sefer Torah, because unfortunately the Columbia exploded into flames on its re-entry to Earth, but that promise made 57 years earlier that the whole world will hear about it was in fact fulfilled, because in fact it made tremendous news. Now, the reason why I chose that particular story to tell my son at his bar mitzvah was because I asked him one pointed question. I said to him as follows, did you choose to be born in the 1990s in the United States of America? As you did not choose that, neither did Joachim Yosef choose to be born in Poland in the 1920s. But you had better believe that your life is vastly different than his. You're living in a land of freedom, with rights, with the ability to choose your course in front of you. But that choice to be born into this generation, into the family that you were born, into the country that you were born into, was not your choice to be made. Before you were born, Hashem said, this is the right generation for you. You'll be born into this family, in this exact birth order, with these types of personality traits, this type of temperament, this IQ. This is the right life setting for you, and you fit into that like a hand in glove. No one that I know woke up in the morning and said, Hashem, I believe you should create me with 180 IQ. Make it an 80 IQ. Hashem, make me 6'4", strong. And they give, no, Hashem, make me 4'6", you know, kind of meek and mild. Not one of us got a chance to choose the life that we lead. Now, we have the chance to go with it as far as we can, but much of our nature, much of our temperament is not based on our choosing. Daniel Goleman, in his book Emotional Intelligence, writes that they do studies now. At 22 months of age, they can tell the nature of the infant. Is the child by nature bold or timid? You can go beyond, you can expand that, but each human being has an inner temperament, has a certain personality type, certain skills, certain natural abilities, and when you look around, you'll find vast inequalities. You'll find some people who are just so talented and others who aren't. You'll find some people who have beautiful, beautiful lives, certainly at least on the outside, and you'll see some people who suffer. I know two brothers, a classic example. One of them, everything he touches turns to gold, fantastically successful in business, happily married, beautiful children, a beautiful life. And his brother is a schlamazel. Everything he touches turns to mud. He can't earn a living. His shalom bias is miserable. His kids are... And here's the observation. You can't tell me that they were brought up in different homes. Born to the same parents, went to the same yeshivas, grew up in the same environment, yet have vastly different lives, and largely not because of anything that they chose. Different people have different skill sets, different talents, different abilities, and when you start looking around, you find vast inequalities. I spoke about 2 weeks ago to a support group in Muncie of severely disabled men, wheelchairs, some visually disabled, but it was one of the most difficult shmuzim that I ever said, because about the distance of myself to you was a man who had no legs. And I had to tell them, and I had to speak about the fact that everything that we consider our life setting, our physical trappings, is irrelevant. Because at the end of our days, they're not going to ask me, was I young, strong, and handsome, and that I have a good physique? Was I mobile? The only question they ask is, based on your talents, your ability, how far did you go? How much of you did you become? How much of your talents did you use? How much of that great individual that you were destined to be did you actually become? And everything else, great wealth, great talents, great abilities, is all irrelevant. It's not that it's not so important. It totally, utterly doesn't matter. And understanding this and relating to this in a concrete way is one of the most significant issues that a person has to deal with. If you don't understand life from this perspective, then you'll have untold numbers of questions on the inequality of the way Hashem delivers talents, abilities, situations in life. And I have a parable that I think well defines this very concept. There was a novel written a number of years ago that has the following interesting story. The story was a professional football player was getting in shape for the Super Bowl Sunday, which was a few weeks forward. To get himself in shape, he was riding his bike on a country road, and as he's riding down the road, there's a winding tunnel. Unbeknownst to him, as he enters a tunnel on this end, there's a car coming from the other end. The angel of death is new on the job that day. The angel of death sees the inevitable, sees the football player, sees the car. The angel of death says, why wait for the bloody, gory, messy end? So he takes the football player out of his body, he brings him up to heaven, and the football player's body is buried. Okay, the only problem is that the angel of death made a mistake. Any normal person would have crashed, would have died, deserves to be where he is. But he was an athlete with keen instincts. At the last moment, he would have veered off, would not have been hit. He deserves to be alive. The problem is his body is buried, he's up in heaven. What do we do now? A whole tumult. So back and forth, they weigh the options, and finally they decide as follows. Let's find a person whose time, in fact, is up, and put the football player back into the body of someone whose time is up and let him recontinue his life. So the cute part of the story is when the football player wakes up in this flabby, pampered body, looks up and realizes he's the owner of this huge estate, he's a wealthy tycoon, and then he says to himself, oh my goodness, I got 3 weeks left to Super Bowl Sunday. So the cute part of the story is when he has the butlers and the maids on the front lawn running football drills as he tries to get his arm in shape for Super Bowl Sunday. Okay, cute story. Here's the punchline. Could you imagine you, the one who I'm talking to, the one who thinks, the one who remembers, can you imagine you put into a different person's life? Could you imagine yourself being put into a different body? Now, whether you can or you can't, that exact event happened to every one of us. Before we were here in this thing we called life, we were under the kisei kavod, we were up in Shemayim, Hashem took me as an neshama, the ayum speaking to you, put me into a life and said, this is your life, go lead it. Put into this body, with this temperament, with this talent base, and this generation, in this exact birth order. with an older nagging sister and a younger wimpy brother, because this is exactly the situation that you need for your growth, for the ability for you to grow. And I believe that's exactly the answer to Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas. You know what Hashem was saying to him? Hashem was saying to him, there are life tests, there are life situations. Great wealth is a difficult life test. When you wake up in the morning and you're really, really wealthy, when you could buy and sell the entire city, and you wake up and you say to yourself, I don't need anyone. I don't need my kids. I don't need my wife. I don't even need Hashem. I could buy and sell the world. That is a very, very difficult life test. And as great wealth is a difficult life test, so too is great poverty. When you don't know how you're going to pay the bills, when you don't know how you're going to pay your mortgage, and you scrape together just enough money, you're driving late at night, you hit a car. You look left, you look right, and no one sees. Do you leave your phone number or do you not? That is a major life test. What Hashem was saying to Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas was quite simple. Hashem was saying, I have lots and lots of money. I have lots and lots of money. The reason you're poor is not because Hashem lacks money. The reason you're poor is because that's the ideal state setting for you. That's the ideal life for you. Do you want me to turn back the world to my sabrishis? Do you want me to reshuffle a deck, find you in another generation in which you might have a better life without poverty that would still be the perfect state setting? Maybe I could find it. Maybe I can't. Because this is the ideal stage setting for you. You fit it like a hand in glove. And that's what Hashem was saying to Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas. It wasn't by accident that you were born into these times. It wasn't by accident that you're suffering poverty. That's what you need as the opportunity for you to become the great individual that you hopefully will be. And this understanding is key and fundamental to understanding life. I claim that if a person doesn't understand this, they'll have untold numbers of questions on God, and every one of those questions will be legitimate. Because without this perspective, very little under the sun makes sense. And interestingly, almost ironically, the vast majority of the people that we speak to on a regular basis don't get this. Not only don't they get this, they have a vastly skewed version of life. I'll share with you an interesting example. Alan Dershowitz wrote a book called The Vanishing American Jew. As you probably know, Alan Dershowitz is the famous Harvard lawyer. He is from the Dream Team. He defended O.J. Simpson, Jewish boy. He writes that as a law professor in Harvard, he was teaching a course in comparative religions. What a law professor is doing teaching comparative religion, I'm not sure. But in any case, the focal point of the course was a survey of the world's religions. And this is what they were doing. They were weighing the religions, which one's got it right, which one's got it wrong, Judaism, Buddhism, Christianity. They went through all of the major religions, and their job was to play judge and jury which parts of which religions are right, which ones are wrong. Okay. He writes in this book that at some point during the course, someone raises the following observation. Religion is but a way of relating to God, maybe serving God. If we're rating the different religions, doesn't it behoove us to rate God? After all, religion is just a way to relate to God. If we're rating them, shouldn't we rate God? So in fact, he writes that they rated God. How did God do it, this thing called creation? Now, before I tell you how God did, what grade he gets, let me share with you some of the background. I guess, from their perspective, you look at the world and you see a lot of beauty, a lot of wonderful things. There's love, there's optimism, there's sunshine, there are flowers, a lot of beauty in the world. On the other hand, there's a lot of rough spots. There are orphans and widows and pain and suffering and a lot of pain. So, on balance, God rates a B minus. Not bad. Not an A plus. Not an F. Somewhere in the middle, God rates a B minus. And he writes that in the book, Vanishing American Jew. You're not sure I'm right. Check it out. Read it. Okay. If I had my opportunity to rate a learned professor, I would give him a grade. I would give him a D for dumb. Not a D because of beliefs. You can believe anything you want. It's a free country. I would give him a D for dumb, for fallacious, false thinking. And I'll explain to you what I mean. Imagine that I pull this pen from my pocket and I say to you, you see this? This is a lousy toothpick. Oh, really? Lousy toothpick. Okay. First of all, who needs this whole clicker thing, right? You know? And this thing over here, you don't need that. And every time I get it right back in my molds, I get it right, I get this blue inky thing. What a lousy toothpick. That would be rather foolish. Why? Because before you rate the craft, before you decide whether it's well designed or not, you have to know what the craftsman intended it to be used for. As a writing implement, Bic did a very good job. As a toothpick, you might be right, it's lousy. But before you rate the craftsman, you have to know what his intentions were for that implement. And I say, before you rate God, you had better have a good, thorough understanding as to why God created the world, why Hashem created man. And if you try to rate God before you did that, you're going to come up with some foolish answers. And I'd like to share with you what I consider a powerful, contained mushel to understand life on a very deep level. Imagine with me for a minute the following. Imagine that you're invited to a health club. It's a very exclusive health club. You've never been there before, but you know the layout, the way it's set up. On the right side of the health club is the gym. In the gym, you have the elliptical machines, you have the weight room, you have all the various things working out. On the left side of the health club is a spa. In the spa, you have the steam room, the sauna, the massage tables. You decide it's been a stressful week. First time in the health club, you're heading right to the spa. But you get mixed up, and you turn the wrong way. And you walk into the gym. And you look around, and you go, what a lousy gym. This is a spa? This is a spa? What are all these red-faced guys? What are those pumping iron? And whoever designed this spa did a lousy job. And Sul Shem explains to us that there are two worlds. When Hashem created the world, Hashem made this world and the world to come. Each has a purpose, each has a plan. Hashem put us in this world. This is the gym. This is a chance to grow. This is the opportunity to mold myself into what I'll be for eternity. This is the gym. When I'm done my job here, I leave this earth, and for eternity, I'm in the spa. That's the place where you enjoy. That's the place where you sit back and enjoy all of the fruits of your labor. When you understand that there are two worlds, you begin to understand that this world has a very, very significant purpose. If you ask someone who works out, is working out fun? The answer is it's very enjoyable. Speak to an athlete. It's very, very enjoyable, but it's focused. There's a reason, there's a plan, there's a purpose. When you understand that life also has a plan and a purpose, and this world has a very focused reason for existence, and the reason I'm here is not by accident, we're put into this world to grow, to accomplish, this is the gym, then life itself begins to take on a whole different meaning. You understand that all of the challenges of life are not incidents that just occur to a person. Hashem tests a person. Hashem gives them the different obstacles, different challenges as an opportunity to grow. And when you begin understanding that there's this world and the world to come, life makes sense. But if you don't understand that, then life itself makes absolutely no sense. And as a matter of fact, I believe that if you think that life ends in the grave, if you sincerely believe, as Alan Dershowitz apparently proposes, that when it's over, we die like Elsie the cow, right? When Elsie the cow dies, she is no longer. If you sincerely believe that when I die, it's all over, then God would not rate a B minus. God would rate an F. God would rate an F for obviously doing a lousy job at creation. And I'll share with you just some quick observations. Anyone here ever suffer something called pain? Pain. Pain. Pain comes in so many different flavors and nuances. If you smash your elbow, it feels very different than if you smash your shin. If you have a stomach ache, it's very different than a toothache. A migraine headache is vastly different than arthritis. Pain comes in so many flavors and nuances, you could probably write poetry about it. Gee golly, why do that? Why create it? And don't tell me, well, it's avoidance pain. I'll grant you there's some pain that has a productive, helpful purpose. If you touch a hot pot, you quickly jerk your hand away. But here's a very interesting thought. That pain is not processed in the brain. That pain is processed in your thigh, in your spine. You see, it takes too long. And when you touch the hot pot, the sensory input is brought to the fingertips, brought along the neural pathway, brought directly to the spine, because it's got to be in a microsecond that you move your hand away. If it had to travel all the way up the spine, all the way to the brain, it would take too long. Avoidance pain is processed in the spine. When you meet a man or a woman who has debilitating arthritis, who can't get out of bed, every movement is Gehenna, ask yourself the following question. What good does it serve them? How does that help them? And I guarantee if you will search from one end of the sun to the other, as long as this person's alive, it doesn't serve them well. But once you understand that life itself is a very, very focused place, that this is the gym, obstacles, the challenges are exactly that. Opportunities to grow, very, very, some difficult, some easier, but every opportunity presented for a person to grow, to accomplish, you begin to understand life in a very, very different manner. And that perspective is something that requires an awful lot of thinking about, an awful lot of dwelling upon, but that perspective is the bedrock basics to everything that we do. I speak in different communities, and sometimes I get interesting reactions. I was once speaking in a particular community, and after I was done, some people came over, thank you, Rabbi, thank you, very nice, very nice, very nice. At the tail end, an elderly couple came over, and the woman said, Rabbi, we loved the lecture. Thank you very much. Husband followed suit. Rabbi, we loved the lecture, but. Now, I've been around the block long enough to know that when you hear the words, Rabbi, love the lecture, but, something's coming. Rabbi, love the lecture, but, according to what you've just said, I've wasted my entire life. I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, I worked all my life, did well, made some good money, but according to what you've said, that we're here to grow, to accomplish, the whole reason we're here, then I've wasted my entire life. Now, I'd like to share with you what it is that I said to them, and then I'll share with you my answer to them. I taught high school for many years. As a high school Rebbe, one of the jobs of a high school Rebbe is to teach some das, some understanding to these young men. Now, keeping in mind the fact that these were all young men from good homes, regular, well-educated fellows, I would always begin the year with the following question. I would look at these guys and say, gentlemen, why don't you sin? Why don't you sin? But I don't mean little sin. I mean really big deal stuff, murder, anything you could imagine. Just do every bad thing you could ever imagine. So typically, the guys would say, well, I mean, are you kidding? Hashem will be angry with me. At which point I would say, so what? Many wicked people have flourished throughout the millennium. Hashem will be angry. Who cares? At which point the fellows would say, yeah, that's now. But when I die, my neshama is going to burn. I don't want my neshama to burn. So I would look at these guys and say, aha. There are many things that you don't do that you want to do. Many things that you do do that you don't want to do so that your neshama shouldn't burn. I have a piece of advice for you. Forget about your neshama. You take care of you. Do exactly what you want. Spend your time as you want to. Why should you suffer here so that your neshama should be well taken care of? Do what you want and let your neshama burn. I'd always say this, standing by the door, and no one was allowed to leave before I answered the question. But I'd like to share with you the answer to that question. Mishael Salanta tells us that the difference between a man when he's alive and when he's dead is literally like a man walking into a room and taking off his coat. Imagine I walk into this room and I take my coat off. I emerge. It's not some other person. Not some distant cousin. Says it Rasul Salanta, when the body is buried, I emerge. But I am the one who am thinking now. I am the one who's alert and aware. But it's not my neshama that goes up to heaven. Not some distant cousin, not some alter ego, not some splintered down version of me. It is I, the one who thinks, when it remembers, the occupant of this body. The body is buried and I separate. But most people never think about life that way and surely don't think about death that way. Most people think about death as going to sleep, as at rest. Harvey was a good man, but he's at rest now. In his final resting place. Right? You go to the cemetery and you'll see rest in peace, at rest. Right? That's how most people think of death, as at rest. But that's fallacious. You see, rest means the following. Imagine you break your arm in throbbing pain. You try Tylenol with codeine. You try Percocet. Nothing helps. Finally, 3 o'clock, you fall asleep. Ah, Baruch Hashem, it no longer bothers you because you're asleep. Most people think of death as in, I will be asleep. I won't be there. My distant cousin, my alter ego, my neshama, whatever that means, will be there. But it doesn't really matter because I'll be at rest. I won't be there. Says the Rasul Salanta, that's patently false. The exact opposite. I'll be alert, I'll be awake. The I whom thinking to with you now, the I who am with you, the occupant of this body, will be there forever. The body won't, but I will be. And thinking in these terms is a quantum leap forward in understanding life. I have a little exercise I'd like to share with you. I want you to imagine the following. Imagine you're in a car, and you're not paying careful attention. Maybe you're texting when you shouldn't be, reading your email when you shouldn't be, and all of a sudden, shattering glass, metal, you wake up 3 days later in the hospital. The doctor looks down in your bed and says, "Son, sorry to be the one to tell you this, but you will never move another muscle in your body. You're locked in." Here's the question. Imagining that you're in that hospital bed, and imagining you're trying to move your arms, and they don't move. And you try to move your legs, and they don't move. You try to sit up, and nothing moves. Here's the question. Are you alive? Well, people come to visit you. They walk in and say, "Oh, you look terrible. Thank you very much. Oh, I feel so bad." "Don't feel so bad. Just do me a favor." "Oh, man, oh, you can't do anything anymore. You can't play ball. You can't... Will you shut up?" Are you alive? You sure are alive. You feel awfully upset with the insensitivity of all the parade of silly comments people make. Would you like to know that there was a book written about a man who existed in that state? The editor of the Elle magazine in France was in just such a car crash and woke up in the hospital locked in. And the book called The Diving Bell is a description of his life in that state. And he describes the nurses. Some were so kind, so wonderful. Some were okay. One he called Attila the Hun. She flies in a broom at night. And he describes what it was like for him. He describes what it was like when his children came in. He felt such joy, but such pain that he couldn't touch them. Was he alive? Well, here's an observation. A speech pathologist devised a method for him to communicate. You see, he was able to move one muscle. He could blink his left eye. And she put the alphabet on a card. She would move her hand down that card. When she got to a letter that he wanted a signal, he would blink his eye. She'd write it down. That book that became a national bestseller in France, that was translated into English, was written by that man in that state. In the mornings, he would write the sentences, compose the paragraphs. In the afternoon, his secretary would stand at the foot of his bed taking dictation, letter by painstaking letter, because he died in that state. And if you'd like an example of the body being dead, but the man, the essence of him being alive, I think that's a very powerful example. But you really don't have to stop there. As you're well aware, near-death experiences are becoming more and more documented, and not by religious writers, by secular scientists. As a matter of fact, Raymond Moody wrote a book in 1975 that caused a near revolution in science, because he documented a few hundred near-death experiences, and all of them have a eerie kind of parallel story. The person's clinically dead, no heart rate, no respiration, no electrical impulses in the brain. They pop out of the body, kind of describe hovering by the ceiling, and they see things that they couldn't possibly have seen because they were dead. And I get a chance to read some of these stories, and I'd like to share with you two of them. The first one involves a 44-year-old man who had a heart attack. The EMTs came to his house, put him in the ambulance, began CPR, and they could not get a response. He was stone dead in the ambulance. There was no heart rate, no respiration. They couldn't revive him. They brought him into the hospital. They brought him right into the ER. They were going to put the paddles on, but before they put the paddles on, one nurse said, "Wait, stop. Maybe he has dentures." She checked. He did have dentures. She took out his dentures. They put on the paddles. They gave him the shock once, twice, and they actually saved him. And he survived. After he began regaining his strength, he asked for his dentures. They couldn't find them. They looked high, they looked low, nowhere to be seen. After a week, a nurse who had been there when he was brought in, but had been on vacation for the past week, came back to duty, and he said, "Wait a minute, nurse, you were the nurse on duty. Don't you remember? You took out my dentures, and you put them in that cart with a rolling cart in the top drawer." She said, "Oh yeah, you're right. And she went to look for that card, found the top drawer, found his dentures, and gave them back to him. But here was the problem. When they took the dentures out of his mouth, he was dead, unconscious, no signs of life, no heart rate, no respiration, no brainwave activity, stone dead. If you yelled at him, screamed at him, he wasn't there. Lancet, which is a medical journal, wrote the following. I went online. I paid good money because I read it originally as an excerpt, and I had to read the original because when I heard about the story, I was awed by it. A 38-year-old woman living in Texas had an aneurysm in the brain, bleeding in the brain, and basically there was nothing that medical science could do for her because the bleeding was in a region of the brain that was so deep that they couldn't help but typically what they'll do is cauteroids. They'll go in there, sear the ends of the bleeding, and prevent further bleeding. The problem was it was in a region of the brain that if they went in there, going in alone would cause so much other bleeding that literally she would hemorrhage to death. They basically could do nothing for her. One surgeon had an idea, a rather experimental procedure. They weren't sure it would work. It basically entailed draining her blood from her body, literally taking out all of the blood from her body, going into the skull, quickly going through the procedure, cauterizing it, closing her up, and putting the blood back in. It was risky, it was experimental, but it was the only possibility to keep her alive. She consulted other physicians, she consulted her family, they finally agreed, she signed on the papers, and they prepared her. But I want you to hear what they did. They put cotton in her ears, put tape on her eyes. They had to make sure that there was no brainwave activity. Any brainwave activity would have caused potentially bleeding. They put her under anesthetic, put her in a bath of ice. They had to make the body as cold as possible. When the core temperature was well below what it normally is, they began draining out the blood from her body. When it was fully drained, the surgeon opened her scalp, went in, found the area, cauterized it, quickly closed it back up. They put the blood back in, and she survived. Interestingly enough, when she began recuperating, at a certain point, the surgeon comes in to visit this woman. This woman says to the surgeon, you know, doctor, I must share with you, I had the strangest hallucination. I had this hallucination when you were operating me. I popped out of my body, and I was watching from above. And I saw that you were holding an electric toothbrush. An electric toothbrush. And you tried to take this electric toothbrush and put it into a vein in my thigh. And you said to the nurse next to you, it won't fit. And the nurse said, try anyway. And you said, but it doesn't fit. And the nurse said, try anyway. And finally you tried and you put it into a vein in my thigh. Isn't that silly? The problem is the doctor didn't laugh. The doctor turned white. Because that was about what had happened. You see, part of the procedure involved taking a medical implement that looks something like an electric toothbrush. He had to insert it into a vein into our thigh. He tried to, but the vein was too small. He turned to the surgical nurse and said, it won't fit. She said, try anyway. He tried again, but it won't fit. She said, try anyway. And eventually he fitted into that vein in her thigh. But here's the problem. When he did that, she was stone dead. In a bath of ice, all the blood drained from her body, no heart rate, no respiration, no brainwave activity, clinically dead. And when you read story after story describing exactly that, you get a very different vantage point, a very different version of life. And when I told these stories to this group, this gentleman said to me, according to what you said, I've wasted my entire life. And folks, I'll share with you an interesting thought. When you're on this side of the shtender, and an 80-year-old man is on the other side, and he says to you, according to what you're saying, I wasted my entire life, and you know that he might be right, it's a very uncomfortable position to be in. So you say the lines that you sort of have to believe, how do we know what our mission is, you still have time, and maybe they're right, and maybe they're wrong, but this I'll share with you. I guarantee, had he thought about that, not when he was 80, but when he was 60, he would have made different life choices. Had he thought about these ideas when he was 20, he would have charted a very, very different course, and he would have been a very different person. The beauty of still being alive, and especially if you're young and alive, is that there's hopefully lots of time ahead. Lots of time to chart your course, lots of time to set your goals, lots of time to make yourself into what you will be for eternity. But that's why we're here. Hashem has much, much capacity to create a world very differently than he did. Hashem could have made man very strong, vigorous, always healthy, without sickness, without disease, without pain. But Hashem designed this world for one reason. This is the gym. We're given many challenges and many difficult situations so that we understand life, so that we grow, so that we reach the levels that we're capable of reaching. But every one of those situations really are only relevant as stage settings. They're not significant in and of themselves. They're not important in and of themselves. They're just opportunities to grow and just a chance to become greater or bigger. But at the end of the day, all of it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, every one of us is judged by one single criteria based on our talents, our abilities, how far did we go. How much do we accomplish based on my God-given talents? What did I do? And I believe that answers question number one. Question number one was, why didn't Hashem just say to Lozem and Bedas, I'll take care of you? Why didn't you just say, I'll provide? The answer is that was the exact stage setting that that man needed, not by accident, not because Hashem doesn't have enough money, but because that's what he needed as an ideal stage setting for him. And that answers one of the questions. But the other question is that Rabbi Elazar ben Bedas seemed to have said something that was inappropriate. Hashem told him, you've made it. You've succeeded. You understood why I put you on the planet. You grew, you accomplished. You reached such a level that your estate in the world to come is so wide and so vast. Imagine the entire state of California. That's your reward. So what's Rabbi Elazar ben Bedas' response? That's all? Just one state? Not two? That doesn't sound appropriate. As a matter of fact, it sounds greedy. I'd like to share with you a very, very important idea. Greed and ambition are very different. Greed is dirty. Greed implies taking something that I shouldn't have. Maybe taking something that you should have. Ambition is a very different sort of animal. Ambition is understanding the value of a human, setting goals and reaching them. Greed is ugly. Ambition is beautiful. And probably the most critical concept a human being could ever come across is one idea. And that is that Hashem did not create any human being for mediocrity. Hashem did not take us from under the kiseh kavod, from under the throne, design for us a custom-made, hand-tailored life, and put us into it for whatever. What are you doing in the world? Whatever. What are you going to be? Whatever. What are you living your life for? Whatever, Rabbi. I'm just chilling, you know. I'm going to surf a little bit, hang out, you know. Whatever. It'll be okay. I'll figure it out in the end when I'm 60, when I'm 80. I'll figure it out eventually. I don't think so. I don't think so. When Hashem took you from under the kiseh kavod and put you into this world, it was to become a great individual, to reach heights, to reach tremendous accomplishments. And when Rabbi Elazar ben Bedas was told he got very, very high, he really reached a tremendous, tremendous level, he said to Hashem, that's great, but I could do more. He understood the value of himself. He understood what he could accomplish. And when he said that to Hashem, Kaviyachal, Hashem was entertained. Giri bach, touche, you've done well, Rabbi Elazar ben Bedas, you're correct. Because that understanding that no human being was created for mediocrity is one of the basic understandings that the world at large doesn't seem to get. We live in the whatever generation, you know, just hanging out, just doing whatever, not thinking much about life at all. That is one of the most debilitating, limiting beliefs that a human being could ever be exposed to. I think there's a tremendous lesson to be learned from this Gemara. Understanding that every human being was given a very exact role to play. Like an actor who's given a very exact script. If the script is to be a very glib, successful, talented individual, it's irrelevant. If his part to play was to be a savant idiot, but he plays it well, he will be for eternity a tremendous individual. You want to hear an interesting thought? The Chazon Ish, one of the Gedolim, living in Eretz Yisrael, he died in the 50s, was a tremendous masmid, always involved in learning. It was rare that he did anything other than look up. When people would come and ask him questions, he would respond and go right back to learning. It was told that when a mentally retarded person would walk into the room, he would stand up. And someone once asked him, what's pshat? Many, many people come. great people come. The Chazon Ish doesn't stand up. When a mentally retarded person comes in, the Chazon Ish stops what he's doing and stands up full height. He said as follows. If Hashem put a person into this world without full mental acuity, if Hashem put a person into this life without full mental faculties, what it means is they've been here before. They've been here before and they've reached a very high level. There's some other area that they need to finish up, so Hashem put them back, because Hashem would not put a person into this world without full mental capacity, because then they couldn't possibly accomplish their reason for existence. It means they reached a very high level, some little area they need to perfect. Says the Chazon Ish, I don't know if I'm on their madrega. I stand up out of respect for that person. A vastly different way of viewing life, a vastly different way of viewing people. And I believe what this Gemara is sharing with us is that perspective, that all of the stage settings, wealth, poverty, great success, great talents, or the opposite, are exactly that. Settings of the stage, they're irrelevant, they don't matter. The only thing that matters is based on my God-given talent and ability, how far did I go, how much of that great individual that I could have been did I accomplish. But I'm not measured for you, you're not measured compared to another person. You and I are each measured by the most exacting standard, how much of me did I become. And I believe that's what Hashem was saying to Rabbi Elazar ben Bedas. It wasn't by accident you were born into this generation, into this time, into this body. It's custom fitted for you. And this understanding that this life is a gym. The opportunity, it's a laboratory of growth. The opportunity to change is one of the basic understandings. If you understand that, life itself has tremendous meaning. If you don't understand that, nothing in life makes sense. God would not rate a B minus, God would rate an F. Once you understand there are two worlds, there's a gym and a spa, this world has a purpose, life has a purpose, all of the questions take on a very different taint, a very different setting. I'd like to close with one last thought. I understand why Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas laughed. If you were told that you have this wide, vast estate in the world to come, you'd also laugh. I understand the beam of light. Hashem was entertained by his ambition, his drive, his understanding of how great a human is. Hashem touched him on the forehead, and the beam of light emanated. But why did he cry? So if you look in Rashi and this Gemara, Rashi says the reason why he cried was because Hashem said to him, you've already lived half of your life. When he realized that half of his life, a full half of his life was gone already, he began crying, oi, bitter tears. And if you think about that comment of Rashi, you'll realize it's a tema, a terrifically difficult statement to understand. Why? Because here's a man who's suffering, not lightly, but suffering such a difficult life that the very first words that come out of his mouth are Hashem, Masai etzara b'alma, Hashem, until when will I suffer? He had a very rough life to the extent that when Hashem says, do you want me to